Thank you very much, Alistair, for that overwhelming introduction. I would like to first thank the University of Sussex for inviting me to give this lecture. I'm a fairly new boy at Sussex, and I feel it's a great honour to have been asked to speak about by this distinguished institution, which is coming up to its 50th birthday. Within the university, as Alistair said, Sussex European Institute has been in the forefront of work on the economics and politics of EU enlargement for the last 15 years. It's developed its reputation at home, and particularly abroad, first under the inspired leadership of Professor Helen Wallace, who's here tonight, and now under the co-chairmanship of Jim Rollo and Alex Shebiak. I should say that among our distinguished past members, there is the Vice-Chancellor of Sussex University. SEI has now a large family. We have students who are now working in all the governments, I would say, of the European Union, especially in Central and Eastern Europe. And some of those are here tonight, so welcome. The European Union is also approaching 50, like the university. Like Sussex University, it too has been a great success. Its numerous triumphs include the development of the world's largest internal market, the creation of a functioning monetary union, and the construction of a system of governance which, while sometimes appearing to teeter on the brink, nevertheless successfully coordinates the work of 27 increasingly different member states. But these triumphs, which are important in their own right, are overshadowed by its greatest achievement, creating an area of peace and stability in Europe in which the fundamental values of democracy, human rights, and the rule of law are upheld to the point that they are considered automatic. Today we can hardly imagine that Greece, Portugal, and Spain passed through dictatorships before joining the Union. These states are now so absolutely normally European that we've forgotten that they were rather different 30 or 40 years ago. But it's the enlargement of the European Union to Central and Eastern Europe which is the most obvious jewel in this achievement. That the peoples themselves in these countries overcame the totalitarian regimes behind the Iron Curtain to join the mainstream of European development is certainly one of the greatest achievements of the second half of the 20th century. Today, these new member states are functioning democracies and successful economies. But the job isn't done. Those far-sighted European leaders who signed the Treaty of Rome 50 years ago next week wrote in the preamble to that treaty that they were resolved by pooling their resources to preserve peace and liberty, and they called upon the other peoples of Europe, presumably all of Europe, who share their ideal to join in their efforts. The obvious success of the European Union means that there is still a long waiting list of countries which want to join. Now, I put this map up. I hope it doesn't offend you that I put a map up. I thought it was quite useful to point out the countries which are actually still in the waiting list. They begin with Croatia and the rest of the Western Balkans here. They, of course, include Turkey. Macedonia, Turkey, Macedonia, and Croatia are all recognized as candidate countries. In the rest of the Western Balkans, we have Serbia, Montenegro, Albania, Bosnia, Herzegovina, and Kosovo when its status is clarified. They're all in this little bit down here. In the east, we have Ukraine and Moldova, and they cling to the idea of eventual membership. And of the Caucasus, and of course Belarus, if it changes its policy at some time. And of the Caucasus republics, both Georgia and Armenia have expressed interest in the Union. It will take many years, and perhaps two decades for some, to meet the conditions for membership, but preparing for accession also gives us stability, which might otherwise not be present. Finally, of course, we have those rich nations of Europe, Norway, Switzerland, and Iceland, which haven't yet made up their mind, and at some time in the future, they may well ask to join the Union, though it seems to me that Switzerland is doing extremely nicely, thank you very much, negotiating with the union as it is. Yet, strangely, just at the moment when the ultimate dream of reuniting Europe appears to be within our grasp, the union itself seems to be turning its back on future enlargement. We see this when we read our newspapers, we hear it often when we listen to our politicians, and even a superficial review of the presidency conclusions of European Council meetings over recent years leaves one with a clear feeling the union is becoming less confident about future enlargement. So this evening I want to explore why this is the case, why it is fundamentally wrong to refuse further enlargement, and what can be done about it. European integration has always been an elite project. Today the construction has become so complex that even many involved deeply with the project are no longer able to explain all the governance rules of the European Union. The elites in Brussels and in the governments of the member states still fundamentally control the development of the Union. Until recently, these elites could govern with little reference to the Union's citizens. One of my old friends, a German permanent representative, I hope no one recognizes who it is, always used to say to me, "Alan, it's no use consulting the people about Europe. They don't understand anything." Citizens of the Union have always supported European integration because it was identified with peace, security and prosperity in Europe. The level of knowledge of the functioning of the Union has, however, always been low, even in the six founding states. Information for many years was difficult to obtain, and though today we have large amounts of information, it's often in the form which makes reading a chore. Citizens in general still look to their national parliaments as the seat of political authority. Very few of them can name their MEPs, and they don't seem to bother to turn out in any great numbers to European elections. But what seems to have changed recently is that citizens have become aware of the significance of Brussels in their lives, and that their elected national politicians have little control over EU business. The referenda in the Netherlands and France on the European Constitution gave the citizens of those countries the chance to make a clear statement of concern. I'm convinced that this change in public attitude is fundamental, not only to the future of enlargement, but to the future development of the Union itself. This change in public opinion has been recognised by the political elites in the member states, a few of which have tried to turn to their own advantage what they see as a rejection of further enlargement, and perhaps of European integration itself, by taking nationalistic positions on a wide range of subjects from sovereignty to national champions. I'd like to analyse the question of the future of enlargement on the basis of the objectives of both the elites and of the citizens, as they're by no means identical. Elites have been debating the compatibility of deepening and widening for much of the last 50 years, as we know. General de Gaulle was not much in favour of widening if it included Britain, but he was also not too keen on deepening proposed by Hallstein, as the Luxembourg Compromise testifies. But the subject became particularly acute with the imminent accession of the EFTA states in the mid-90s, and then again, and more particularly so, with that of the Central and East European states in the early part of this decade. Let me recap very, very briefly a little of the history of the 1990s. When the changes came about in Poland and Hungary in spring and summer 1989, and the wall fell in Berlin in November of the same year, the political leadership of the European Union was actually taken rather by surprise. The Union was still consumed by the programmes to complete the internal market, which was the great political objective after 1985. Indeed, some of Europe's politicians regretted the passing of the Iron Curtain, which had allowed them peacefully to pursue their policies of deepening integration in the Union. Even perhaps the most enlightened foreign minister in the Union, Douglas Hurd, looking back in December 1989, is quoted as having said that Europe divided by the Iron Curtain was a system under which we had lived quite happily for 40 years. The defeat of communism was, of course, welcomed by most of the Union's political leaders. Many of them gave jubilant speeches, and President Delors, I remember, at one stage made the famous remark that they should act on their Sunday speeches. They shouldn't remain simply as speeches. However, not many of them really thought beyond the immediate triumph of communism. The new leaders in the East, however, had concluded early on that accession to the European Union was an essential part of anchoring democratic and market economy reforms in their countries. Pressure on the Union mounted, therefore, with urgent requests in the face of instability in Russia for the negotiation of association agreements with the Union. The first Solidarity Prime Minister in Poland, Tadeusz Mazowiecki, insisted on the need for a strong contractual relationship with the Union in his contacts with Jacques Delors back in the early 90s, and his successor, Jan Szyszko-Pilecki, created an Office of European Integration in the Polish government already in January 1991 with the aim of preparing Polish accession to the Union. By this time, by the early 90s, the deepening agenda had grown from the completion of the internal market to include monetary union and institutional change. The end of communist rule split the elites between those who considered that enlargement would slow down further integration in the Union and those who gave priority to extending the area of peace and stability in Europe. This divergence of opinion affected the European Commission at the time, as well as many administrations in the member states. The European Economic Area Agreement was devised partly to avoid an enlargement to the EFTA members, and a variety of proposals were made to ensure that the integration of the new democracies in Central and Eastern Europe would not lead to their accession. One might have expected at that time that the German government would have taken the lead in handling relations with the new democracies as well as moving integration forward. But it was overwhelmed at that time by the work required for German reunification. There simply were not enough German civil servants to go round at that time. Once the first strains of reunification were over, Germany decisively moved to support both processes. And with hindsight, we know that both of these processes, deepening and widening, continued in parallel. These same arguments that were going all the way through the 90s continue today when we have 27 member states. In June 2006, the European Commission was asked by the European Council to evaluate the absorption capacities of the Union in relation to future enlargement. In a very diplomatic answer, the Commission left the door open to new accessions, but suggested a way of tightening conditionality still further to make accession that little bit more difficult. France, with one of the least enthusiastic elites in the Union, has been leading opposition to further enlargement and has gone so far as to require referenda to be held in France before accession treaties can be ratified. This doesn't catch Croatia, if any of you are from Croatia. They can still come in without a French referendum. From then on, there'll be French referenda. Only last week, in the margins of the European Council, which agreed on all of those environmental things, it was again widening and deepening, which was one of the main disputes over the contents of the declaration on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome. But beyond these fundamental policy issues, the institutional questions related to the future of the Union are also of great importance to the elites. As the number of member states increases, so obviously does the level of diversity. Diversity of interest probably will complicate the policy process because the aims of the member states will be different and perhaps even irreconcilable. This will put a strain on decision-making in the Union, especially in areas which require unanimity. In the view of some member states, further enlargement can't be considered unless decisions have been implemented which reform the institutions. It is, of course, the complex reactions to a possible accession of Turkey which explain both elite and popular behaviour. It's certainly true that under current institutional arrangements, the arrival of Turkey would put a certain strain on the Union's institutions and policies. There is, however, also no doubt that the accession of Turkey, having met the strict conditions set by the Union, would be a major benefit to the Union. As far as the public is concerned, the initial scepticism of the elites about enlargement doesn't seem to have been shared. This slide is the result of a Eurobarometer question in 1990, and only 15% of those questioned did not agree with extending EC membership, EC at that time, to the new democracies in Central and Eastern Europe. You can see in all of these questions, increasing the EC budget to help them, offer them treaties of association with the Union, extend EC membership to them on request, allow them to benefit from specific EU programs and resources, and speed up the European community's political, economic, and monetary integration. All of those things come in with a resounding majority. In 1990, however, the public didn't know very much about the countries which had been hidden behind the Iron Curtain, and they didn't have very much information about the impact of enlargement on the European Union. Nevertheless, even with increased levels of information and knowledge, support held up quite well throughout the 1990s, in spite of the public becoming more aware of the consequences of enlargement. This support appears, however, to have fallen away after 2001, as this slide shows. According, again, to the results of Eurobarometer, the decline in the old member states was continuous through until today, from about 2001. So the top blue line is the percentage of respondents who were for enlargement. Whatever that colour is, mauve line are those who are against, and the don't knows are at the bottom. If you look at that slide, you can see from this period here, round about the end of 2001, there was a downward trend until spring 2004. This jump, of course, is the new member states, which suddenly joined, and the new member states are extremely enthusiastic about enlargement, not just, to be fair to them, not just their own enlargement, but lots of other people's enlargement. So we get that jump up there, which masks a continuous fall in support in the old member states. And then from once that adjustment has taken place, the steady decline continues. So that today, those in favour of further enlargement only have a very narrow lead over those who are against. An opposition is strongest, unfortunately, in the old member states, in the old large member states. In this last Eurobarometer survey, it was Germany, France, and surprisingly the United Kingdom, which were the least enthusiastic. It's difficult to say with complete confidence why this decline in support for enlargement has taken place. It would seem that for some people, immigration is equated with EU enlargement, and that they fear changes in their way of life caused by large numbers of immigrants arriving in their societies, what the Germans often call Überfremdung. But economic arguments are certainly very important. EU enlargement is considered part of globalization, which is perceived as destroying jobs in the EU, creating high levels of unemployment, and reducing wages. Economic reasons were clearly at work in the French referendum on the constitution, where it was the regions with the highest level of unemployment which voted no. We, of course, don't know how much of the opposition to the draft constitution was a result of opposition to enlargement. Fear of the budgetary costs of enlargement, however, is unlikely to have played an important part in public thinking, as there's no direct link at the moment between the EU budget and taxation. The recent decline in support for enlargement may, of course, be linked to the results of the fifth enlargement to the Central and Eastern European countries. So let me look briefly to see if there are any impacts of that enlargement which could explain the decline in the popularity of enlargement. Theoretically, we would expect any enlargement to be good for the EU economy, bringing countries relatively rich in skilled labour but poor in capital together with the EU 15, where factory endowments are rather reverse, should lead to an increase in the productivity of both labour and capital in the Union, assuming that these factors can move. Indeed, we see that is happening, although the restrictions placed on the free movement of labour in the accession negotiations by most of the EU 15 countries has meant that migration has been concentrated on those member states which opened their labour markets, notably the United Kingdom and Ireland. Fortunately, I would say, thank you very much, Germany, for shutting your door to migrants from the new member states, because they came to the United Kingdom instead. The new member states have all grown rapidly since accession, with a considerable inflow of capital, both from the EU and from outside the EU. From 2004 to 2007, the average annual real economic growth rate of the 10 new member states has been around 5%, with extreme values in the Baltic countries, I think Latvia considers now that it is a bit too extreme. But you can see that in Estonia over that period, the first column is 2006, the lighter coloured blue is 2000 to 2006. You can see that over that period, 2000 to 2006, Estonia has been growing on average at something like 9% a year, Latvia at 8%, and Lithuania at something like 7%. And if we go down to the European Union, we can see that we have a pretty dismal performance over that period. So as a result of this rather good growth in the new member states, unemployment has come down from rather high levels that were around 2000. Here again, the first column is 2000, and the second column is the latest number, January 2007. And you can see that some of these high peaks, like Slovakia, where it was getting on for 19%, or Poland here at 16%, Lithuania above 16%, all of these values, unemployment, have come down. And so the recent unemployment levels at the beginning of this year are on average something like 8%, 8 or 9%. The economies have also shown surprising stability. Here you have consumer price inflation, the left-hand column being 2000, the right-hand column 2005, and you can see that the countries with the very high peaks in inflation in around the year 2000 have managed to bring inflation right the way down. And Poland has now such low inflation that it actually stopped Lithuania from joining the monetary union because of the rules, which I won't go into, of Maastricht. You have to have an inflation level which is not much above the inflation level of the three lowest countries in the European Union. One of those was Poland, and so there can't be any love lost between the governor of the Central Bank of Lithuania and the governor of the Central Bank of Poland. So the process of catching up the EU 15 in these countries is well underway. But there's plenty of evidence that the EU 15, the old member states, have been gainers from this integration process as well. Trade has expanded between the EU 15 and new member states, and the old member states still have considerable trade surpluses, as you would expect. Many West European companies have shifted labour-intensive parts of their production to the new member states, and this has allowed them to control costs and to compete globally. While the newspapers have highlighted a few cases of complete production lines being shifted eastwards, a sober look at the statistics shows that this has had only a very marginal effect on employment in the EU 15, in the old member states. In 2005, just to give you one figure, in 2005, intra-EU 25, in other words, foreign direct investment going between the 25 members of the European Union, amounted to €340 billion. Of this, only 22 billion went from the old member states to the new member states. In other words, just 6% of foreign direct investment taking place in the European Union went between the EU 15 and the new member states. Those countries which opened their labour markets to workers from the new member states haven't suffered any negative effect on unemployment, and they've profited from the new labour input and from its benign impact on inflation. But that's all very interesting. But the real bonus for Europe as a whole, of course, has been the extension of the Union's values into Central and Eastern Europe, augmenting political stability in what might have become an unstable region on the Union's doorstep. The main negative impact could be the wage effect in the low-wage sector, in those countries which have opened their labour markets to workers from the new member states. Without the migration which followed enlargement, wages in this sector would probably have risen slightly faster, leading, of course, perhaps to a little higher inflation. On the other hand, recent research suggests that the wages and salaries of middle and high earners have actually risen faster than they would have done without migration. Naturally, As with all structural change, some people have suffered from the movement of capacity from the old member states to the new. There have been several celebrated cases shown on television all around the European Union. These negative stories obviously affect public appreciation of enlargement, even though they give a completely false view of the global impact of enlargement on the Union. Objectively, then, the fifth enlargement of the Union has had a positive impact on the economic situation of member states, both new and old. So the decline in the popularity of enlargement is slightly baffling. But the fifth enlargement coincided with a downturn in the European economy, which had nothing to do with enlargement at all, and which led to higher unemployment in the core states of the Union, and notably in Germany and France. In this slide, I put confusingly different years in the same colour. So if we look at Germany, which is these set of columns here, the first yellow column is unemployment in 2000. The next one is unemployment in 2005. Then the first green column is youth unemployment in 2000 and youth unemployment in 2005. And the fifth red column there is long-term unemployment in 2000, followed by long-term unemployment in 2005. So you can see that unemployment rose in Germany and in France at that time, between 2000 and 2005. It rose in Germany from 7.2% in 2000 to 9.5% in 2005. And in France, it rose from 9.1% to 9.9%. Youth unemployment also rose sharply in both countries. This is a dreadful situation. You can see here in France, where you have well over 20% youth unemployment. That's to say, the percentage of young people in total unemployment in the year 2005. Long-term unemployment also has been extremely high and rising in those countries. You can see long-term unemployment as a proportion of total unemployment in Germany is actually, was in 2005, actually over 50%. In the top corner here, I've just put the growth rates in those years. In Germany, the growth rate in that period was 0.25% a year over 5 years. In France, it was only 1.5%. This period also coincided with a realization that the globalization of economic activity would mean considerable changes in economic structures and in the continental European version of the European social model. So you had rising unemployment, rising youth unemployment, rising long-term unemployment at a time when people were suddenly realizing that their social model was going to disappear at some time in the future. The worryingly slow pace at which the member state economies were adjusting to change led the Union to adopt the Lisbon Agenda in 2000, the aim of which was to encourage structural adjustment in the light of the growing speed of economic globalization. Governments in general, however, at the beginning of this decade, were slow to take the necessary measures, and a report which was prepared after 5 years, a midterm report by Wim Kok, gave an extremely dismal assessment of progress. High unemployment, less job security, and a squeeze on public budgets at national, regional, and local levels has led to considerable public resentment. In many cases, this resentment has been turned by national politicians against enlargement, and indeed against the whole idea of European integration itself. The problem for politicians is that the changes which are required by the Lisbon Agenda imply a break with the traditions of social protection which have grown up since the last war. Some politicians have faced down opposition in order to push through reform, but they are a minority. And they did so at a risk of political disaster. If you think back to the German example, Gerhard Schröder introduced reforms in the social security system, fairly mild reforms, and that cost him extremely dearly in the following election. These reforms in Germany were underpinned by the private sector, fortunately, which, using rather tough measures, unfortunately sometimes threatening their staff that they would move capacity to Eastern Europe, nevertheless rationalized extremely rapidly, so that German unit labor costs have remained stable throughout this whole period from 2000 to 2005. In other countries, however, governments have hardly started to tackle the necessary reform. Some of them have begun to look to protectionism as a way of avoiding reforms, and in France, the presidential candidates are both blaming some of their country's troubles on the last enlargement and on globalization in general. In a recent speech in Strasbourg, Nicolas Sarkozy, with impeccable logic, said, "I believe in free trade, but in free trade that is controlled, regulated, where the state intervenes to compensate against social and ecological dumping." He went on to say, "I want a Europe where no country can practice social dumping. I want a Europe where European financial transfers cannot serve to finance fiscal dumping which hurts other member states." This was an obvious attack on the tax regimes in some of the new member states, and also a threat to their financial transfers from the structural funds of the Union. It's true that this may be electioneering, an attempt to match the protectionist speeches of the socialist candidate, but it mirrors some of the political messages coming out of other member states, and indeed out of the United States itself. But we know that protectionism will only make our problems worse. We've been good at enjoying the fruits of globalization, but we must also face the challenges it poses, not through a hopeless protectionist policy, but through structural change. I'm convinced that the main cause of popular opposition to enlargement comes from the supposed link with poor economic outcomes and high unemployment, and the fact that though change is necessary, citizens don't like it, and little is done to help them understand why it's necessary. So if we want to reunite the continent, we must propose practical and effective remedies for the perceived problems of both these elites and the citizens. Tackling the problems of the impacts of increasing diversity on institutions and policies will not be easy. I'm sure it will also require changes which will offend some of the purists in the Brussels elite. However, we should remember that even in highly integrated federal countries like the United States of America, there are major differences in policy and law between the states. There are even differences, as we all know, in local tax rates. We're already beginning to see a watering down of the monopoly of the community method of governance, in which the European Commission proposes, the Council and Parliament decide, and the European Court of Justice rules on legality. In a more diverse union, we'll also have more flexible systems in the policy process. I also expect that we'll see the Amsterdam rules on enhanced cooperation, as amended by the Nice Treaty, being tested at some time in the future. With greater diversity, there is a far greater probability that groups of countries will wish to forge ahead in certain policy areas in which other member states will not be interested. Because I'm galloping after the time, I was going to say something about the Eurozone, but I'm going to leave that to discussion afterwards. But the Eurozone is obviously one of the first examples of this enhanced cooperation in the Union. Apart from enhanced cooperation, I am sure there's going to be much more intergovernmental agreement, totally outside the treaties, but between EU member states. There are two examples today. There's the Treaty of Schengen and the Treaty of Prum, and they suggest that this may well be a way of innovating in certain policy areas where it's impossible to get agreement within the treaties, either according to the community method or the rules on enhanced cooperation. These agreements, like the Schengen Agreement, may later be written into EU law. This increased flexibility would put an end to the Commission's monopoly of initiative, but then in fact this has already happened. The European Council and the Parliament today often effectively tell the Commission to draw up draft legislation in areas which are important to them, reducing the Commission's role to that of a civil service. In the first part of the draft constitution, if that were ever to be passed, and we're not sure about that, it would also become possible for 1 million citizens to ask the Commission to draft legislation on behalf of themselves. There are, however, dangers in this increased flexibility, so we shouldn't go over the top. Certain policies would have to remain unaffected by the proliferation of enhanced cooperation. The Nice Treaty already lists several of them in Article 43. Obviously, that includes the internal market. The internal market can't be affected by enhanced cooperation. That's obvious. It's also obvious that other common policies, like the common commercial policy, can't be affected more flexibility. Flexible integration also can't conflict with the rest of the acquis communautaire. And it will also pose a major problem of management for the Council, the Commission, and for the European Court of Justice, which will have to police an increasingly complex union legal construction. But this is a price worth paying for a more inclusive European Union, in my view. Reforms to the Union's institutions and their procedures will also be necessary to maintain efficiency and effectiveness as the number of member states increases. The question is whether the measures proposed in the first part of the draft constitution will be sufficient, or whether even more dramatic changes are needed. These are vital issues because the Union is just not a talking shop, as we know, but a set of institutions in which decisions of great importance to all member states are taken. It must therefore remain efficient and effective as a regulatory machine and a policy initiator. It's really too early to say whether the enlargement from 15 to 25 and now to 27 member states has had any fundamental effect, either on the overall efficiency of decision making or on the more qualitative characteristics of procedures and behaviour in the Council of Ministers. In a recent paper by Hageman and de Klerk-Saxer, they find that although the Council is still working quite efficiently, there are changes in the way the Council operates. It's become much less of a club and much more formal. So apparently some changes are taking place, though the overall efficiency of the Council is not declining. Meetings have become longer is one of their findings. The fact that over the last 2 years decision-making in the Union has not become drastically more complicated and difficult, and yet the climate in the Council has changed towards more formality, may point to gains in efficiency in procedures. As the number of delegations around the table increases, so it becomes necessary to organise meetings better. More prior consultation, positions laid out in writing, available to other delegations, stricter sharing of discussions, all of these things improve efficiency and work in the member state, in the opposite direction to the increase in the number of member states. So we lose the club atmosphere, which is so much a part of Brussels life, but perhaps we replace it by simply more efficiency and more effectiveness as the number of members of the European Union increases. Apart from these efficiency questions, there are also equity issues which are beginning to pose problems. Enlargement has brought a large number of quite small countries into the Union, and future enlargement will bring even more. Today we have just 6 largest countries, that is to say the Germans, the UK, the French, the Italians, the Poles and the Spaniards. These 6 large countries have a total population of 340 million, and we have 21 other countries, small and medium size, which have only 146 million. Yet in the Council, the 6 large states have 170 votes, and the remaining member states, 175. The Union's obligation towards the Western Balkans will bring potentially another 7 small countries with a total population of around 24 million into the Union. Where the unanimity rule prevails, proposals can be blocked by any one of these smaller states, although obviously at some political risk to itself. In decisions using qualified majority voting, 14 countries with 55 million could block any proposal supported by the 13 with 430 million. This slide shows the population share in the first column, the share of council votes in the second column, and the share of European Parliament seats in the third column. So if we take those 6 large states, which make up 70% of the population, they have something a little less than 50% of the council votes, and they have a little more than 50% of European Parliament seats. If we take the other states, you can see the relationship is exactly opposite. Now, this is an old tradition of the European Union, of course. The small states have always been more heavily represented in the decision-making bodies than the larger states. But with enlargement, the overall size of the Union institutions also becomes a serious issue. The Commission now has 27 members, the European Parliament, 785 members. I looked the other day and discovered, to my interest, that there are twice as many voters in India with many, many fewer members of Parliament. But I'm not sure we should perhaps follow the Indian example. Yet for the... We have 27 commissioners and 785 members of the European Parliament. It's difficult to imagine new accessions leading simply to incremental change. Yet for the member states, it's important to have their own commissioners in Brussels. You ask an Estonian whether he can do without a commissioner in Brussels, and he will certainly say no. It's also important for Brussels to be able to relate to these countries through their commissioners and their members of the European Parliament. The draft constitution tried to deal with certain of these institutional challenges, more qualified majority voting, a new voting system which gave the large members slightly more influence, the size of the commission and parliament, as well as efficiency and effectiveness through the appointment of a longer-term chairman of the European Council and of a coordinator of foreign policy, which was rather arrogantly called the Foreign Minister of the European Union. Extending qualified majority voting to a far wider number of policy areas would, of course, be a big step on the road to efficient decision-making in the larger Union. The proposals in the draft constitution don't go very far in this direction, and it will probably be some time before significant changes can be agreed. The continuity proposed in the draft constitution through the appointment of a chair of the European Council, who could become a powerful player in the Union, would also help to keep the Union on track with a larger membership. But given the size of the challenge of enlargement, will this be enough? Many other institutions around the world operate successfully with more members than the Union is ever likely to have. Just take the Bretton Woods institutions, the WTO, the United Nations. These are, of course, very different institutions from those of the Union, and they've all solved the problem of the efficiency of decision-making in different ways. But common elements of solutions to this challenge appear to be the establishment of an inner core of decision-making, as in the UN Security Council, and or the creation of constituencies of member states, as in the IMF. Both these approaches may be necessary to ensure, in the longer term, that the Union can continue to expand the area of peace, stability and prosperity in Europe while remaining relatively efficient in decision-making. Jacques Attali, who used to run the EBRD in London, wrote an interesting report for the Quai d'Orsay just before the last enlargement, in which he proposes that the maximum number of delegations in the EU Council of Ministers should be 20. He doesn't explain why it should be 20, and we shouldn't ask, but that's the magic number beyond which efficiency and effectiveness in the Council get lost. He proposes that the smaller member states should be grouped in constituencies, the countries in any one constituency having to decide how their representative in the Council should vote. France, of course, has a constituency of its own. So does the UK, so we can relax. Other ideas have been canvassed for reform of the Commission. The draft constitution foresees a reduction in the size of the Commission to 2/3 the number of member states, and that would mean there would only be 18 at the present time. And they would be selected according to the constitution from the member states, with all countries treated equally. The alternatives include creation of senior and junior commissioners while retaining the right of each member state to send a commissioner. My own experience in the Commission suggests to me that it works best when there are fewer commissioners than today, and they have to be of rather high quality. A further possible way forward might be the more frequent use of non-regulatory techniques, such as the open method of coordination, which is the hallmark of the Lisbon Agenda, or other forms of quasi-decision-making, which are more flexible than the community method. Lisbon makes use of a fairly sophisticated set of indicators of structural reform in the form of benchmarks, which are not legally binding. The system, in fact, works through mutual nagging and encouragement in a closely integrated union. No member state can be brought before the European Court of Justice. The open method has been criticised, often by lawyers, for being ineffective, but in a large and diverse union it could well play a greater role. If we could go back to the drawing board, of course, we'd design a rather different set of institutions for the enlarged union. However, institutions, once they're there, they usually change slowly and by small steps. And I'm sure that this will continue to be the case in the union. Revolutionary changes to maintain full effectiveness, such as those suggested by Jacques Attali, would clearly lead to losses of influence for certain member states. But changes will be decided by unanimity, remember, and it's difficult to imagine member states voting to lose influence. The Council continues to operate, nevertheless, at 25 and now at 27. The addition of Croatia would not substantially change the performance. Additional efficiency gains in all the institutions are undoubtedly possible. And with the changes proposed in the draft constitution, it's likely that the Union could continue to operate effectively with substantially more members than it has today. While some of the institutional changes which were proposed in part one of the draft constitution are not very controversial amongst the public, more serious changes obviously will be. But in my view, the growing public resistance, as I said before, to further enlargement is due more to the economic problems I've mentioned than to the institutional changes at the centre. Globalisation has become an objective of popular anger in France and Germany, but in many other member states as well. It's not only Monsieur Sarkozy and Madame Royale who have been calling for protectionist response. More alarmingly, politicians not facing immediate election have been doing the same. The only possible response to globalisation is structural change in our economies. The presidency conclusions from last week's European Council note, with rather typical optimism, member states are determined to take full advantage of improving overall economic situation to strengthen the momentum for reforms and thus to further improve Europe's global competitive position. In certain manufacturing sectors, and in some services, it will be impossible for the Union's businesses to compete with China, India, and other rapidly developing countries. These countries can fall back on large numbers of unskilled but cheap labour moving from rural areas to the cities. Our response must not be to protect businesses which get into difficulties and which are unviable in the longer term. Instead, through raising educational and training standards, we must ensure that high-quality staff are available to work in new industries and services in which we can compete on world markets. This will require considerably more investment in education at all levels from kindergarten to university, and I think I can count on the Vice-Chancellor to support that. At the same time, labour markets must be made more flexible to ensure that people are not permanently excluded from work. Liberalisation will mean that the reward for lower skills will probably rise more slowly, but we must strive to ensure that through the offer of lifetime training, people of all ages have the chance to upgrade their skills. However, there will be losers in this strategy of structural reform, and the Union and its members have a responsibility towards them. We know that we can only make the situation worse by introducing measures which are designed to protect, but which do not give an incentive to retrain for new jobs. The measures which are taken should work in the direction of encouraging the structural change, which is so necessary if we in Europe are to prosper in the future. This was the idea of the small globalisation fund, which was introduced this year, financed from the Union budget. This fund can support active labour market measures to help those put out of work through the impact of globalisation. While there's a risk that the fund may be used politically for dubious purposes, there is an argument for increasing the amount of money available in order both to cushion the impact of large-scale job losses and to accelerate structural reform. If the Union pushes hard for structural reform as a response to the challenge of globalisation, it also has a responsibility to ensure that those affected by the change receive help to improve their skills in order to find alternative employment. Indeed, if it doesn't, it runs the risk of being mired in a plethora of protectionist measures which will put the Union itself at risk. In a recent paper entitled "Will Global Capitalism Fall Again?" Geoffrey Friedan considers the reasons that the last great period of globalisation before the First World War came to an end. He concludes that to avoid another failure in capitalism, This will require a delicate balancing act. On the one hand, there's the need to build a global economic order, but on the other, the need to commit the resources to maintain the social and political stability necessary for national political economies to reap the fruits of international economic integration. Structural reform and measures to assist the vulnerable would transform the economic perspective of many in the Union, many who today oppose enlargement because of fear for their jobs and the welfare of their families. The review of the budget and union policies due to take place in 2008 or 2009 will be a good opportunity to look more closely at these issues. Allow me then very briefly to summarise my argument. The highest good that the European Union has to offer its citizens and elites is peace, stability and a reasonable prosperity. The enlargement of the Union has been one of the main instruments to achieve this goal through the geographical spread of the Union's values and regulation. Enlargement to the Western Balkans and Eastern Europe will further extend these gains to the benefit of our neighbours and ourselves. These decisions, however, can no longer be taken by elites in Brussels independently of the Union's citizens. It is therefore necessary to tackle both the reservations of these elites and of the voters. The elitist worries about the policy process and the efficiency of union institutions are serious and shouldn't be underestimated. However, more diversity in the way policies are formulated has already become evident, and this trend will continue, and rather than listening too closely to European lawyers, we should encourage it. The institutional issue is likely to be eased by a combination of greater efficiency and certain reforms already proposed in the draft constitution. The popular disillusionment with enlargement may be partially the result of general worries about the volume of immigration. However, in my view, it's mainly conditioned by the perceived negative effects of globalisation. The right policy here is to continue on the path of structural change suggested by the Lisbon Agenda. Any return to protectionism would be disastrous for future generations. At the same time, however, careful consideration at union and national levels must be given to helping those who are affected by globalisation to retrain for new skills which are in demand. In situations of full employment, people feel secure, they can plan their futures, and they are more likely to welcome new member states to the Union. I regard the open hostility being shown by some politicians in the Union to future enlargement as a danger to peace and stability in Europe. It puts at risk stability in the countries which are hoping to become members, and it therefore puts at risk stability in the Union itself. This is particularly true for the Western Balkans, which have the promise from the Union that they can join when they meet the conditions. In my view, we are still quite a long way from overcoming the division between East and West in our thinking. 40 years of division have ruptured the notion of a Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals. Belgrade and Kiev are very distant concepts for people and politicians living in London or Paris, but they're just as much part of Europe, and we neglect them at our peril. In 50 years, the European Union has grown from a small group of 6 states to include 27 today. It's been an enormous success, just like the University of Sussex. We shouldn't now turn away from finishing the job. Thank you very much.
Alan, thank you very much. We have a short time for questions now, so the floor is open. There are roving microphones. If you want to ask a question, please hold your hand up. And when you have the microphone, can you tell us who you are and keep your question as brief as possible? Yes, please.
Thank you. John Bones, retired from the University of Sussex. Alan, I really... The whole topic of your talk tonight, obviously, was on the European Union. And whilst I and many others, of course, are all in favour of that, I'm a little bit hazy, and many other people are, about the enlargement going into areas which, in fact, like Turkey, which has been promoted by the present government and Mr. Bush and others, and other countries which, in fact, geographically, when I was at school, were part of Asia. We are talking about Europe. Has, in fact, the demarcation moved unknown into the schools, insofar as I'm concerned, geographically, so that in fact the borders in fact are being pushed further back into Asia. And are we in fact encroaching into what was formerly part of the Soviet empire, which in fact may, to, from their point of view, look as an economic move or maybe a military move of in fact encapsulating the former Soviet Union from former times. My last point is, if in fact Turkey isn't admitted at some time in the future with their vast population and cultural differences and so on, how long will it be before their neighbours, Syria, Lebanon and so on, are again going to be looking to coming into Europe as well? It may well be that in the future that's what we will be looking at, but there are vast differences and vast cultural problems which I think you hinted at, and I hope that that will be part and parcel of the Euro Commission, and that is that the populations should be voting, not just the people in Brussels, of enlargement in Europe.
Do you want me to take them one by one, or?
Yes, please. I think that was quite a substantial question for you to take in one, yes.
Well, do we know what Europe is? I don't know. Helen Wallace, I seem to remember writing an article which was something like a message from an island off the coast of Europe. I can't remember the exact title. So we're not too sure what Europe is. For me, the important thing is that the fundamental values of the European Union, which are mentioned in the treaty today, and which would, if this the first part of the Constitution was ever approved, would be described better there, that these values, these fundamental values, expand outwards so that the area of peace and stability increases. Turkey, if Turkey is going to join the European Union, it is going to have to meet the most ferocious conditionality that any country has ever had to meet to join the European Union. At every European Council, the conditionality, the conditions which it has to meet to join the European Union are ratcheted up. At the last one, look at, the European Council in December last, again, ratcheted up the conditions that are going to affect Turkey. So if Turkey actually gets to meet those conditions, Turkey will be meeting the fundamental values of the European Union. And that would, in my view, be an enormous advantage to all of us, even to those of us living on an island off the coast of Europe. So has the demarcation moved? I started out in life as a geographer, but I forgot all that a long time ago, and I'm not sure. What is important for me is that the European Union system, the European Union's values, and if possible, our regulatory system gradually moves out so that we have a larger and larger area where we can all live happily and peacefully. Is it dangerous to move out into the Soviet Empire? I should be in Ukraine again next week advising the government on their new agreement with the European Union, which they're just about to start negotiating. Basically it's a question about Russia, right? Russia never seems to have been worried tremendously about European integration. They get terribly worried about NATO. They've never said anything seriously negative about the accession of the Central and Eastern European countries. They've never said anything negative about President Yushchenko's desire to eventually join the European Union. So I am not at all sure that extending the European Union out eastwards is very dangerous at all, and I think it's enormously important. With a Polish colleague, we advised President Yushchenko before the Orange Revolution, and everyone was enormously enthusiastic about all of the changes taking place in Ukraine, and I think that it's very important that where you have people who want to take over, want to adopt the values of the European Union, that should go forward. What do we do about when we've got Turkey, then there's Syria, and then there's Lebanon, and then and so on and so on? Probably not in our lifetime, right? but I think it's a question of our values being shared by other people. So I don't exclude anything, but I am sure that enlargement has been the main tool for making sure that life in Brighton or life in this building is safer than it would have been had this enlargement never taken place.
Thanks. Leslie. Yes.
There's a
microphone coming your way.
I have a parade ground voice, my Chancellor, but I'll use the one I used to speak to you in the old days. Used to be Vice Chancellor, set up, say, with Helen, and before that, External Relations and European Commission. I agree with every word of what the Speaker said and his analysis, and that's exactly the way any right-thinking person should think and argue. But when you think about it, the prospects in reality don't look quite so good. I don't see those very necessary things happening soon as being politically possible in restructuring. And I'm certain on Turkey, and that's an elite project. I'm pro-Turk, any Foreign Office man is, good fellas. But I don't know there's any popular consent for this, and I really don't see it happening. And what then happens to Turkey in terms of the rebuff, I hesitate to think. But can I ask whether the Speaker takes comfort from one or two other considerations which I think may help us, which I could call rather pompously external federators, things that really the EU27 can only tackle if they work together. And I'm thinking, of course, of migration, the wider picture, not movement within. And I, too, have a Polish plumber. Organized crime, climate change, and energy security. Now, there's no way we're going to get a grip on those unless the EU works together, in which case perhaps the elite and the people would pay closer attention to what the lecturer said in his piece. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Remember by the time Turkey meets all the conditions which we have set it, a few years will have gone by. You're completely right that if we now had a pan-European referendum on Turkey's entry, it would fail. It would fail in France, it would fail in Germany, it would fail in Austria miserably. It would also probably fail in this country. But we're talking about a 10 or so year span, and I take quite a lot of comfort from Germany, I must say. I'm sorry, I have rather a large part of my family is German. When you think back just 2 or 3 years, we were all saying, what a hopeless place Germany is. Look at their growth. It's 0.25% a year over a 5-year period. And yet, in a relatively short period, admittedly with a lot of political courage, Germany seems to have turned the corner. I mean, there is much more to be done. But today in Germany, growth is back to 2.5% or more. Unemployment is coming down very fast. And employment is increasing, which is very important. Now, all of that came about, you know, had we been talking in 2003, it would have looked a hopeless case. But we've managed to turn the corner, admittedly with a lot more to do, in a very small number of years. It seems to me that if we can get the economy right, and I must admit we do seem to have a French problem, but if after the French election, and obviously what's being said now is pure electioneering. If you look at Sarkozy's speech in Strasbourg 2 or 3 weeks ago, it was the most amazing tirade. It was Fidel Castro in French. But once we're over the French election, it's not at all excluded that new president and the new government will begin to take the Lisbon agenda more seriously. Obviously, in terms of the future of the European Union, I think you're dead right. I mean, we need to be working in areas like migration, energy, climate change, and so on. And that's actually what the Union has started to do now. I mean, I was surprised, even in this country, that last week's agreement on climate change seemed to change even the atmosphere. You know, I live in Tunbridge Wells, I'm afraid. Even disgusted of Tunbridge Wells looked up and said, my God, something positive is happening. So I agree with you that these things are the sorts of things which the Union must do, because no one else can do it, and these are the things which will strengthen the Union. But as confidence returns to the Union, then so will the appetite for enlargement, in my view. So I don't think everything is lost, even though you're right. If we look today, it wouldn't be too happy, especially for Turkey.
I think we've got a question down the front.
Yes, my name is Jaakko Laajava. I'm the Finnish ambassador here in London. Thank you very much for your very, very comprehensive and good analysis. I can certainly agree with almost everything, but just for the sake of an argument, I certainly agree with the general tone that indeed the sentiment and the enthusiasm regarding enlargement is slowly coming down and vanishing. But the elites, the decision makers, have not really gone with this thing. You referred to the council meeting in December, and I happened to follow that very, very closely because of the Finnish presidency. And indeed, although the addition of the absorption capacity with a slightly different name was added there, we did not change the conditionality. It's still the same criteria. It's still the old thing. And we decided specifically that the commitments that we have made, yes, they will be kept. There will be no new commitments, but the same conditionality applies as before. So I would like to take issue a little bit with your comment about that you know these conditions have been ratcheted up many times. I'm sure they are very, very tough, but this is not yet changed to the extent that it would be contrary to the idea of enlargement. Thank you.
Ambassador, you're right, but what a hell of a job you had to keep some of the other member states under control. I mean, there was an enormous push to have, from certain member states, to have a lot more negative said in the council conclusions, which were resisted, fortunately, by your government and by some of the other member states, which are more favourable towards enlargement. But it was, if I remember rightly, quite a tough job. And so although you held the line, and I think the German government would hold the line, you know, later on we'll have other presidencies, and those presidencies may well steer in the opposite direction. So although the Finnish presidency was brilliant in holding the line, I think it's still quite a dangerous sign that so many other member states were rather negative. So I hope you're right, and I hope that the elites have not given up on enlargement, but I think in one or two countries they have for the time being.
I'll take the last question from you, William.
William Wallace, I'm the husband of a former professor at the University of Sussex. I would put to push you further on the large states and small questions, if I may, Alan, in two respects. One, you talked about Prüm and Schengen. You didn't talk about the Heiligendamm Group, which is six big states that get together, including the British, to fix the agenda for the third pillar before these blasted small states come along and make their long speeches. seems to me that's an indication of a trend once we're at 27, 28 or more that is likely to go much further. Ministers from large states either don't come to council meetings or come very briefly for the lunch and then leave it to their junior ministers or civil servants. I want you to comment on that. Secondly, in terms of enlargement, small states are easier to absorb because they know they're rule takers, they have to adjust. Larger states, as we see with Poland, expect when they come in to be able to shift the terms of the discourse. And we're already seeing from the current Polish government the reaction to coming into a community and then being asked to be a rule taker rather than to change the terms of the discourse. Turkey and Ukraine would be similarly difficult as members to take on board. Large states are much harder to absorb than small states.
Okay, William, you're obviously right that the large states are getting together in more and more places to fix the agenda and to basically take the decisions. And my suggestion was that that process will go on, and I actually don't see any way around it. I mean, the figures that I showed and talked about suggest that unless that does from time to time take place, there are going to be lots of people which get more and more frustrated with the union. Small states reason, I'm very tempted to jump in and defend Poland, but I think I'm going to resist it tonight. Poland has a government which is a bit difficult. I mean, it could have a different government, right? I mean, the next prime minister of this country may be a bit more difficult than the current one. I don't think Poland is going to be always a problem. And I don't think it's always true that your large states are necessarily going to be difficult. Obviously, small states are easy to deal with, although William, Cyprus may have quite a lot of influence, even though it's a very, very small state. I was actually, I cut because I saw Alistair was looking at me rather sharply. I cut out a whole chunk of what I wanted to say, which was about integration with the European Union, but not membership. In other words, what Frau Merkel calls privileged partnership. Is there a situation where instead of taking all of these countries in, which may make the institutions difficult and so on and so forth, we integrate them with the union's internal market, but they don't actually join? I mean, we tried this with the European Economic Area Agreement, if you remember rightly. It was supposed, Jacques Delors thought it was going to keep all the EFTA countries happily there, fully integrated into the internal market, but not joining. What happened? Well, they all deserted on day one and applied for full membership because they realized that someone else was making the regulation that they had to carry out. So all of the schemes which have been worked out so far to keep countries out while at the same time integrating them, they've all failed. And the latest one, which is European Neighbourhood Policy, which is designed to define a whole ring of neighbours around the European Union and to give them eventually, when they have adjusted to EU laws and so on, to give them a share in the internal market. That's the latest scheme to keep neighbouring countries out. And the interesting thing with that is a real paradox. I mean, Ukraine is part of this European Neighbourhood Policy. If Ukraine successfully integrates with the European Union's internal market, if it becomes really quite deeply integrated with the Union, of course it will apply to join because it will have nothing to lose. By joining, it will at least have a say in what new regulation is going to be passed. So the paradox of European Neighbourhood Policy, the latest scheme, is that if it's successful, it will fail. It will fail to keep countries out of the European Union that it was designed to keep out. So, yes, I'll discuss Poland with you outside.
Well, with regret, I must say we must end the question and answer session at that point, because otherwise the lecture organizer would be looking at me with a beady eye. I'm sure we all agree that we've heard this evening a lecture that combined learning, understanding, experience, commitment, and optimism. And on behalf of all of us, and on behalf of the university, I'd like to extend a very warm thank you to Alan for an excellent University of Sussex lecture. And thank you all for coming.